Adele Jones versus Alan Uchtman. Morning, Mr. Tauber.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Andrew Tauber on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Adele Jones. Because the District Court summarily dismissed Mr. Jones's habeas petition in a cavalier and capricious manner, this case should be remanded. Relying on empty formality, the District Court willfully ignored Mr. Jones's ineffective assistance claim, although that claim was clearly presented in precisely the same manner as his Apprendi claim, which the District Court had no trouble identifying and addressing on the merits. As for the Apprendi claim, the State concedes that the District Court erred in holding Apprendi inapplicable to Mr. Jones's case. In fact, Mr. Jones has alleged an Apprendi violation. He was sentenced under a facially unconstitutional statute, and whatever waiver he may perhaps have made of his right to a jury trial did not extend to that statute and was in any event fatally flawed by the trial court's necessarily... Yes, Your Honor, you have a question.
No, you finish. I'm preparing.
Whatever waiver he may have made was fatally flawed by the trial court's necessarily erroneous admonition as to his Sixth Amendment rights under that statute. But before discussing the constitutional claims any further, I'd like to dispose of the timeliness issue. As much as I had relished the prospect of trying to convince this court to overturn its decisions in Gutierrez and Gildin, that issue now seems moot. Based on information that the state provided late yesterday afternoon, it is now abundantly clear that Mr. Jones's habeas petition was filed within the statutory time limit. The parties agree that the 2244D limitation period began to run on September 4, 2001, the date that Mr. Jones's conviction became final. By the state's calculation, which Mr. Jones accepts, 35 days had run by the time Mr. Jones filed his application for state post-conviction relief on October 11, 2001. That left 330 days on the one-year limitations clock. There is no dispute that the time was told during the pendency of Mr. Jones' state post-conviction application. The issue is, how long did the limitation period toll? In its brief, the state claims that Mr. Jones filed his federal habeas petition 20 days late. The state reached that conclusion by adding to the 35 days that had already elapsed the all days after February 5, 2003, the date on which the Illinois Supreme Court issued an order denying Mr. Jones the right to appeal the denial of a state post-conviction application. But according to the information that the state, to its credit, provided me late yesterday afternoon, on March 22, 2003, Mr. Jones filed a motion in the Illinois State Supreme Court seeking reconsideration of the order denying him leave to appeal. That motion was docketed on March 28, 2003, and ultimately denied on April 8, 2003. Thus, rather than resuming on February 5, 2003, as the state had alleged in its response brief before this court, the limitations clock did not restart until April 8, 2003, or 62 days later than the state had asserted in its brief. When measured from April 8th rather than February 5th, 2003, only 325 days had elapsed on the limitations clock by the time Mr. Jones filed his federal habeas in the Northern District of Illinois, even if this court were, pursuant to Gutierrez and Gildin, to include the post-conviction certiorari period. So either way, based on this information, it is clear that Mr. Jones's habeas petition was timely filed. Were this court to disagree, I certainly would be happy to urge the point on Gutierrez and Gildin and the equitable tolling, but in light of the new facts that were presented yesterday by the state, I don't think that's necessary, and I would move on to the substantive constitutional claims.
Let me just ask you one thing. If he gets a new sentencing hearing or a new trial, is he aware that he could do worse the second time around?
I have not discussed that point with him specifically, so I'm not sure what his level of awareness as to that fact is. Though I would not having researched this point, I wouldn't want to speculate right here. I don't believe he would be exposed to the death penalty again after the court had reached the conclusive determination that that would be an inappropriate sentence in his case. But as I say, I have not researched that point. I wouldn't want to stand and provide citation right now. Before moving on to the ineffective assistance claim and the Apprendi claim, I think it's worth noting that while the state argues that regardless of the district court errors on these points, the dismissal should be affirmed because Mr. Jones cannot possibly meet the standards set forth in 2254D as to the evidentiary showing necessary to overturn the state court's determinations, on the record as it currently stands, neither this court nor the district court could possibly decide one way or the other whether Mr. Jones could make the requisite showing. The record simply is not sufficiently developed for determination on the merits at this time. And that is why the case should be remanded to the district court for proper determination and hearing. On the ineffective assistance claim, the district court relied on Northern District Illinois Rule Local Rule 81.3 in dismissing the claim. It appears from what happened below that the court's reliance on Local Rule 81.3 was pretext at best. The district court had absolutely no difficulty in identifying Mr. Jones's Apprendi claim, which was presented to it in precisely the same way that the ineffective assistance claim was presented to it. And the district court then went on to reach the merits of the Apprendi claim, albeit deciding it erroneously, in our view. Now, in order for the district court to have missed Mr. Jones's ineffective assistance claim, it would have had to have actively averted its eyes from the petition before it. The Apprendi claim was the second of the two claims raised in his initial petition. So the district court would have to have ignored the first 10 or so pages and only gotten to the second half for it to have found the Apprendi claim, but to have missed the ineffective assistance claim.
Ineffective assistance claim, it's a hard one here. I mean, Jones confessed.
Your Honor,
to facts, that would lead to a conviction for both the aggravated vehicular hijacking and the murder.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but that, of course, puts...
I just wonder what any attorney could have done under those circumstances.
Well, what an attorney could have done under the circumstances was to investigate the circumstances by which that statement to the police was taken and whether or not the statement was, in fact, as a legal matter, voluntary. And from what is visible on the current record, there is absolutely no way of knowing whether that statement was voluntary or, more importantly, in the preceding fact, whether the attorney did anything to investigate the circumstances surrounding that statement. Now, there are two, and from reading the Illinois Appellate Court decision on direct appeal, which is the only facts we have available given the paucity of the record as it stands now, the only bits of evidence linking Mr. Jones to the crime were his statement to the police and the stipulated testimony of his cousin, Ms. Polk. Now, as I just noted, the testimony of Ms. Polk was stipulated to by the defense counsel. That surely is questionable at best. There is no reason to believe that the defense counsel investigated, for example, whether Ms. Polk had been offered a deal by the prosecution in exchange for her testimony. There's no indication that defense counsel investigated what possible personal animosity of a familial nature there may have been between Mr. Jones and Ms. Polk. Standing here today, I don't know. But it certainly was incumbent upon trial counsel at the time of trial to conduct that investigation. This court and the Supreme Court has emphasized, particularly in capital cases, the importance of pretrial investigation by counsel. Standing here today on this record, neither this court nor I nor the district court can say whether or not trial counsel conducted the necessary investigations.
So what would an investigation have shown?
I am not certain, Your Honor. That's precisely why it's important to have the investigation.
Some sort of presumption that the trial counsel is acting properly. Wouldn't you have to come in with something to show that the stipulated testimony shouldn't have been stipulated to because, and then...
But the place that I would have to come in and show that would be in the district court, Your Honor, not standing here today on this record when the district court did not even allow opportunity for the trial record from the state court to be put into the record. I mean, I think the first thing we'd want to do is look at the trial record, see what actually happened at trial. that would be the first step. And I believe, it's my understanding from having spoken with Mr. Jones, that he was a habitual drug user at the time of the crime, was using drugs on a daily basis, multiple drugs. And so I, as a trial counsel, would want to know, well, what was his state of mind at the time he gave this purported statement to the police? Was he high? Was he sober? That's just not known from this record, and it should be remanded so that Mr. Jones will have the opportunity to have the record developed to answer precisely the sorts of questions that Your Honors are posing. Now, as I say, the district court relied on Local Rule 81.3 in dispensing with the ineffective assistance claim without even asking these questions, without looking to the record, which it didn't request. And that reliance is surely misplaced. There is nothing in Local Rule 81.3 on its face that precludes incorporation by reference. And indeed, if it did expressly preclude incorporation by reference, it would then be invalid under 28 U.S.C. 2071, which requires that any local rule be compliant with rules promulgated by the Supreme Court. And the rules promulgated by the Supreme Court for the conduct of 2254 cases expressly allow incorporation by reference. Rule 4 foresees, or indeed commands, the district court to examine any exhibits that are attached to the petition, and Instruction 5 for the national form, which was duly promulgated by the Supreme Court under its authority of 28 U.S.C. 2072, expressly foresees the attachment of additional pages and the attachment of a brief, which is what Mr. Jones did here. So there's no basis in the local rules for disallowing what Mr. Jones did, and indeed the national rules promulgated by the Supreme Court foresee precisely this sort of approach. As for the Apprendi issue, the state concedes that the district court erred in holding Apprendi inapplicable. Now, again, as with the ineffective assistance claim, ultimately this court is not in a position to decide the merits now, nor is the district court in a position to decide the merits now, because the resolution will turn on, in part, I would suggest if you don't accept my facial challenge, the nature of the waiver and the exact waiver and the advice counsel gave to Mr. Jones at the time, which we don't know on this record. There's no dispute that Mr. Jones had a right to a jury determination beyond a reasonable doubt of any sentence-enhancing factor. The state argues that his right under this was not violated because he did receive a beyond the reasonable doubt determination of the aggravated vehicular hijacking conviction, and he had waived his right to a jury trial. But even reading the Illinois Appellate Court decision on direct appeal, it is plainly apparent that his waiver of his right to a jury trial did not extend to the Murder One statute under which he was ultimately sentenced. Whatever waiver he made was limited to the capital statute, not the Murder One statute. But he was sentenced under the Murder One statute, not the capital statute. Indeed, the trial court's admonition specifically excluded the Murder One statute under which he was sentenced. He was informed by the trial court that were it to get to that stage after the capital portion of the trial, that he, the trial judge, alone, without the participation of a jury, would make a determination as to any aggravating factors that might or might not exist. That admonition was a misstatement of Mr. Jones' Sixth Amendment rights as recognized in Apprendi. And any decision he made based on that admonition infected the waiver he might have made as to the trial as a whole. And so the waiver here is at issue. It's impossible to determine the merits at this stage, given the lack of a record, and it should be remanded for further hearings. Unless the court has questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thanks. Good morning, Mr. Coleman.
Good morning. Good morning, judges. My name is Ira Coleman. I represent the respondent in this case. I'd like to start off with the proposition that this court can affirm on any ground supported by the record, and this record supports that this petition is time-barred. Now, before yesterday, there was very little dispute between the attorneys as to the days that were being calculated. I calculated it as 20 days late because I was trying to give the prisoner the benefit of the doubt, and the prisoner had calculated it at 22 days late. What was discovered yesterday because I was being also as generous as I could be and double-checking and triple-checking with the Illinois Supreme Court to make sure of the dates, is that the petitioner filed a motion for reconsideration out of time following the denial of PLA from the Illinois Supreme Court. So 22 days after the Illinois Supreme Court denied PLA in the post-conviction proceeding, he filed a motion for reconsideration that was out of time, it was untimely, and it was also not accepted by the Illinois Supreme Court because the Illinois Supreme Court does not allow a petitioner to come in with a motion for reconsideration. The petitioner must come in with a motion for leave to file a motion for reconsideration or a motion for rehearing. So a motion for leave for reconsideration was denied a month later after the time for filing any kind of reconsideration motion and after the mandate had already issued. So while I discovered this information yesterday and I was trying to be prudent and give counsel the benefit of the doubt and give them everything that I received, it didn't affect the time bar issue, and I'm happy to supply this court with a 28J letter or some sort of additional pleading just so you can have the documents. But if you had the documents, you would see that it doesn't affect the time bar issue at all. And if you'd like to address the other issues on rebuttal, I just want to say it doesn't address the time bar issue.
Why don't you send us a 28J?
With just the additional documents?
Just so we have everything.
Sure. I'm happy to, because I would like the court to at least have all the information. I'd like all of us to have all the information to make sure that if it is time barred, let's make sure that it is time barred. But it is time barred, and it was able to be determined on the record, and for that reason, this court should affirm. Now, apart from this dispute about the dates, the only other thing that the parties dispute is whether or not the 90 days following the denial of PLA in the post-conviction, not on direct review, but in the post-conviction, that a petitioner can seek for certiorari to the Supreme Court, should toll the limitations period under 2244D2. And the other issue is whether or not the equitable tolling applies to this case. Now, with respect to the 90 days for seeking certiorari to the Supreme Court, this court in Gilden, in Gutierrez, and it reiterated in Note 1 of Modrowski and other cases that the 90-day period does not toll the limitations period for when it's in the post-conviction. If it was on direct review, that's a different story, and that's 2244D1A. But here we're talking about 2244D2, and that 90 days, according to this court, doesn't apply and doesn't toll the limitations period.
That's the issue that the Supreme Court's just granted cert on, is that right?
Well, actually, there are two cases, and I filed a 28J letter earlier this week informing the court about Lawrence versus Florida, but in the Day case, which was argued February 27th, if you look at the transcript, you'll see that the limitations issue is not really before the court.
In Day or in Lawrence?
In Lawrence, I think it's more before the court in Lawrence. I don't think it's so much before the court in Day, which was the case that was cited to by my opposing counsel, but I think in Lawrence it may be before the court if the Supreme Court decides it a certain way. If the Supreme Court decides that even when a prisoner files a petition for certiorari, that time doesn't count, clearly the time for filing when he didn't file wouldn't count as well. So it could be that Lawrence decides the issue, and if the court wanted to wait for Lawrence to come out, in case it does decide the issue, I can understand that. But before Lawrence comes out, the law of this circuit right now is that the 90-day period does not count. And it's the law that every circuit except for the Sixth follows. So where every circuit, including this one, follows that, I would ask that the court follow its own precedent. Now, with respect to the equitable tolling, the petitioner has asserted four grounds for equitable tolling. And even if you take his grounds as true, and even if you take his allegations as true, as a matter of law, they don't warrant equitable tolling in this case. In order for a petitioner to obtain equitable tolling of the statute, he must show circumstances, extraordinary circumstances beyond his control, that prevent him from filing. Not simply affect him from the filing, but actually prevent him. So when he's saying that he was in administrative segregation for a period of time, and he's saying that he doesn't receive his mail as timely as other people, or that he doesn't have complete access to the law library, while that may affect the time for filing, it doesn't prevent him from filing. He could have had months after even if he didn't receive the PLA denial from the Supreme Court until 6 days or 6 weeks later, he still had the rest of the period in order to file. The year that we're talking about is not a year that shifts every time something happens during that period. That's the way the limitations period work. We all understand that we're not going to receive mail the minute that something happens. With respect to the other issue, that there's an allegation of fraud, that some legal organization put themselves out to file his petition for him, this court in Modrowski and in cases following that have expressed that attorney misconduct, whether it's negligent or willful, so willful misconduct, is not enough to warrant equitable tolling. And that is because the prisoner always has the responsibility to make sure that his petition gets filed on time, even if he has to prepare a duplicate petition when he thinks an attorney is doing so. So even if the attorney fraudulently took his money and said, I'll file a petition for you, or he took his money and said, yes, I filed it, but then realized he didn't file it at all, he forgot to put a stamp on it, it's still the prisoner's responsibility. And I know this is a harsh rule, but that just happens to be the rule that Congress wrote, that the prisoner has to check with the court, he has to oversee the actions of his attorney, and he has to make sure that his petition is getting filed on time. And if it's not, then let him file his own petition. Let him file a duplicate. He can do what he actually did in this case. It was a few sentences, and it was a portion of his state appellate court brief. Here's a petition. And what will happen is exactly what happened in this case. The district court will accept the petition and then tell him how to do it properly. But as far as timing is concerned, it will consider that date that he filed that petition. So in this case, as you'll see if I file a 28J letter, time bar is an issue in this case. The 90-day rule does not apply according to this court's precedent and every circuit except for the Sixth, and the issue of equitable tolling does not apply even given the allegations of the petitioner. Now, if this court decides not to rule on the time bar issue, if it chooses that it can't do so sua sponte, if it chooses that you want more information about the equitable tolling or that you want to rechange some of your previous language, even if you don't look at the equitable tolling, the timeliness issue, this judgment is still an affirmable judgment. And with respect to the Apprendi issue, yes, the state concedes because the district court was wrong when it determined that Apprendi does not apply retroactively to this case. For the reasons that the district court cited that Apprendi didn't apply are exactly the reasons why Apprendi does apply. His direct appeal was pending at the time that Apprendi was decided. But apart from the fact that he erred on the procedural ruling, the district court's determination that there was no Apprendi violation is clear from the record. In this case, the trier of fact, which was the trial court judge, determined beyond a reasonable doubt the facts that set the sentencing range in this case. The trial court judge, because he waived his right to a jury at every stage of this case, the trial court judge determined that the defendant committed first-degree murder during the course of an aggravated vehicular hijacking. Once the trial court determined that, once the trier of fact determined that, the petitioner was subject to the penalties that were in 91H, I think is a subsection, or 581, which were either death for the death penalty or life, or any sentence in between 20 years and life. Once the judge made the determination that the defendant was eligible for the death sentence, and there has been no challenge to that. There's been no challenge in the state courts that there wasn't a showing beyond a reasonable doubt. There's been no challenge about waiver in this case, or he didn't properly waive the issue. The issues in this case have always been about Apprendi. So once the trial court judge found beyond a reasonable doubt the facts that set the sentencing range, when he found that there were mitigating evidence that were apparently effectively shown by his attorney, so his attorney, at least in the sentencing, was clearly effective. Once he found that he was not eligible for the death penalty, the trial court doesn't have to go back to re-find those facts beyond a reasonable doubt. And once the petitioner waives his right to a jury with the death eligibility, he doesn't get to have a jury with the 581 statute to begin with. Apprendi does not entitle a prisoner or a defendant to have a jury determine a sentence, only to have a jury or a trier of fact determine beyond a reasonable doubt the facts that set the sentencing range. And that's exactly what happened in this case.
I want to ask you something because I found a certain amount of irony in your footnote 9. Page 27, because here's what you argued. You argued for the purpose of determining whether his petition complied with Rule 81.3 that we should ignore attachments, documents that are incorporated by reference. But when it comes to determining whether to dismiss his petition under Rule 4, you argued that we should consider the face of the petition and any exhibits attached to it. I mean, it seems to me these are somewhat inconsistent arguments. If the attachments help him, you say ignore them. If they help you, you say they're dispositive. Respond.
Okay. There, certainly. So that brings us into the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, actually. All right, so let's get to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. In this case, the district court made a procedural ruling that it was not going to review the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And then if you look at the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, you'll see that it's clearly without merit, given the state appellate court's addressing of the issue. But with respect to the procedural ruling, it was not error. In every 2254 case, and I don't think anyone's going to argue about this, it is imperative that prisoners file their petitions on the proper form, because the proper form elicits information that is needed before a court can ever get to the merits. In looking at a petition, a district court can certainly look at the petition, but what is not allowed is to actually refer to other parts of the record. So if the prisoner puts his claim on the petition, then we'll bend over backwards. The courts will bend over backwards to liberally construe what the claim is. However, what they're going to draw the line with is referring to other documents or other pleadings that are being referred to.
Look, I understand that there's a separate instruction sheet that directs the petitioners not to incorporate other documents by reference. But in what sense should that be treated as binding? It's not part of a local rule.
Well, it's certainly the instructions on how to fill out the form. And if you look at the form itself, it directs the petitioners to fill in the where provided on the petition. It's the claims that it has. It says state briefly the claims that you had, and I think it may even say if you need additional space, then attach something. This is what's happened in this case. You have to look to see what happened in this case. I mean, I want to back up a little bit. What happened in this case? The petitioner filed not a form petition. He filed a page of a few sentences of the history of his case and a section of his appellate court brief. And what the district court did was it accepted the petition and then issued an order saying, okay, this is not on the proper form. So here, would you please file it on the proper form? And in that order, there was an actual trial court order here. There's a district court order that said, when you file it on the proper form, this 2254 petition, the amended one, will be the petition. You have to put your claims in this petition. And the district court is not going to look back at the previous petition. This will be your petition. And the instructions of 81.3 actually follow what this court actually does, is that you can't adopt by reference in your brief arguments. You have to actually present them to the court. In 81.3, the instructions to it tell the petitioner that's what you have to do. And in this case, what the petitioner did was when he filed his 2254, for every place for him to describe what the claims were, he said, see original petition. He didn't put ineffective assistance of counsel, see other petition for explanation, or Apprendi, see other petition. He put see previous petition. If you look at this petition, there is no way to determine what his claims are. And this court has stated in Small versus Endicott and in United States versus Brack that you cannot adopt by reference other arguments. And the reason for this is because you don't want state prisoners, or you don't want prisoners coming in and writing on their 2254 petition, see all state filings in this case, or all filings on behalf of the defendant in this case, and then he submits a box with all the records and everything. How is a court supposed to go through and sift through and figure out and construct what the petitioner's arguments are at that time? That's why there's a bright line rule that you're not allowed to adopt by reference, and that just happens to be one of the rules that courts are sticking to. Now, I think I have a minute left. With respect to even if you find that there was procedural error with not looking at the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, in this case, there was no ineffective assistance of counsel. And if you look at the state appellate court decision, it sets it out very nicely. And even though the petitioner points to different things that the attorney didn't do, that he didn't cross-examine this witness, that he didn't cross-examine that witness, and he didn't challenge this and that, what this court should be mindful of is the very smart, I think, very smart defense, and certainly not ineffective, of what this attorney did. with the mountain of evidence in this case, he decided not to object so much to the actual killing, but rather to challenge the aggravated vehicular hijacking. And if the attorney were successful in getting a not guilty verdict for the aggravated hijacking, then the death penalty is off the table. And the aggregating factors under 9-1B are off the table. And the petitioner would then be looking at a sentence of only 20 to 60 years. And if the aggravated hijacking came out to be a not guilty, he becomes a much more sympathetic defendant and may have gotten something closer to 20 years. But there is no rule that says that a counsel has to challenge every aspect of the state's case. In this case, given the evidence, it was smart to do what the attorney did. And it's certainly not unreasonable that the state appellate court came to that conclusion. I see that my time is up, and unless there are other questions.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'll quickly touch on the two subsequent points before moving back to the timeliness issue. As for the ineffective assistance claim, the state says there was no way for the district court to determine what his claims were. That's patently not true. The district court did determine from his petition what the Apprendi claim was. It could just as easily have determined what the ineffective assistance claim was. And as for the attorney's strategy of challenging the aggravated vehicular hijacking, how do we know that? There's no way of determining on this record what the attorney was doing or not doing. We need a better development of the record. On Apprendi, the state says that there is no error because Mr. Jones waived his right to a jury trial at every stage. We challenge that. We challenge the effectiveness of his waiver. We challenge on the basis of the unconstitutional statute under which he was sentenced and the admonition that was tied to it. Now, as for the timeliness, it appears from the face of the documents which Your Honors will receive from the state that the Illinois Supreme Court did consider the motion for rehearing on the merits and denied it on the merits. But be that as it may, the motion for rehearing was filed and was considered and was disposed of. That tolls the time. I would direct Your Honor's attention to the Tenth Circuit decision in Serrano, 383 F3rd at 1185, the Eleventh Circuit's decision in Nix, 393 F3rd at 1237, and the Fifth Circuit's decision in Lookingbill, 293 F3rd at 261. All the circuits to have addressed this issue find that the filing of a motion for rehearing tolls the habeas clock. I would also direct Your Honors to Supreme Court Rule 13.3, which clearly states that the time for filing a petition for writ of certiorari does not begin until after a motion for reconsideration, even if untimely, has been filed and disposed of. I see my time is up.
I'm going to give you another minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. As for Gutierrez and Gildan, I would submit that this court should overturn those two decisions. I would submit they are clearly wrong. The fundamental error made in Gutierrez and Gildan is the unspoken assumption that a petition for a writ of certiorari is somehow separate and apart from the underlying application for state post-conviction relief. It is not. The Supreme Court's power to consider a state application for state post-conviction relief rests not on its original jurisdiction, but on its appellate jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1257. In order to be considering something on its appellate jurisdiction, the underlying action must still be pending. And there's no dispute that a person has 90 days to file the petition for writ of certiorari. The Supreme Court may then, on the 90th day, grant the writ of the petition. So there's no possible dispute that throughout that 90-day period, when the Supreme Court can exercise its appellate jurisdiction, that state court petition for post-conviction relief is still pending.
How untimely was the motion for reconsideration in the Illinois Supreme Court?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that, having only learned of the motion late yesterday afternoon.
Does that make any difference?
I do not believe so. I believe under the cases I've cited to this court and under Supreme Court Rule 13.3, which will allow petition for certiorari 90 days from even an untimely
Well,
file.
What if the motion was filed 3 years after the fact?
I acknowledge that there might be some reasonable risk rule that's implicit in that, but certainly here where it's a matter of weeks, I don't think such a rule would come into play.
And what about the fact that Mr. Coleman maintains that there is no such thing as a motion for reconsideration? There is only a motion to request a motion for reconsideration.
Well, looking at the documents, the first was titled a motion for leave to file a motion for reconsideration, so apparently petitioner complied with that. And then the order that was then issued on April 8th says that a motion for reconsideration having been filed, this is hereby denied. So the court seems to have treated it as a motion for reconsideration. And in the Looking Bill case out of the Fifth Circuit, a court surely not known for its liberality on habeas matters, the court recognized that even motions for reconsideration that are not proper under the technical rules would nonetheless toll the time for habeas filing in the federal courts. Any further questions, Your Honor? Thank you.
Thank you both very, very much for such a well-argued appeal. Thank you very much. And, of course, as always, you have the deep thanks of the court for your pro bono efforts.